Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Jamie Myro will be telling us a little bit about PHA Canada. So, can you tell me a little bit about PHA?
The Pulmonary Hypertension Association of Canada is the association for people living with pulmonary hypertension and their families, caregivers, and healthcare professionals.
And, So
the mission of the organization is to empower the PH community through support, education, advocacy, awareness, and research. So it's really a full spectrum, full scale health charity supporting a small rare disease patient population.
So how do you go about reaching out to the affected population?
We rely heavily on our relationships with care providers in particular. So we're fortunate in Canada to have a strong network of PH expert treatment centers across the country. So we work closely with the medical providers, the doctors, and the nurses to provide resources directly to patients. And then beyond that, of course, through our own communications and digital outreach in particular, through things like social media and our web presence and our website. And then sometimes we even partner with other patient support programs that might operate to provide treatment support to patients, again, to just distribute information about resources and our programs and services.
So how does PH typically affect a person?
Well, there are many different kinds of pulmonary hypertension, but essentially what pulmonary hypertension is it's characterized by a buildup of pressure, a high blood pressure, in the arteries of the lungs in particular. And so this results in, the pressure results in buildup on the right side of the heart and can cause enlargement of the right side of the heart and ultimately can lead to heart failure. So people with pulmonary hypertension, regardless of the type that they might have and where it might originate from or be caused by, experience shortness of breath in particular, especially upon exertion, sometimes even very minor exertion, walking up a slight incline or climbing a flight of stairs. Even things like bending over can be quite difficult due to a lack of oxygen in the circulation system. And then fatigue is often also really, really common. And then other symptoms like blue fingers and lips and extremities, or fainting can be common, heart palpitations or chest pains, and edema or swelling in the lower extremities in particular, the feet and the ankles and the legs. All of those things can be common symptoms.
So do you know offhand about how many people are affected by pulmonary hypertension?
Well, we estimate that in Canada there are at least 5,000 people and upwards of 10,000 people. It would really also depend on which type of pulmonary hypertension you're talking about, because some are more common than others. Folks with pulmonary arterial hypertension, which is one of the rarest forms of PH, are make up a smaller portion of that 10,000. As do people with chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension, hypertension that's caused by unresolved blood clots in the lungs. Those two types of PH have PH-targeted treatments, but they also make up the smallest proportion of that population. Other folks are probably experiencing pulmonary hypertension as a result of other underlying heart or lung conditions that is affecting, the functioning of the arteries and the lungs.
So, in your work, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions about PH?
Well, I mean, to begin with, most people have never even heard of pulmonary hypertension. So right off the bat, you're talking about a rare condition or a very uncommon condition that people have just never heard of. It gets mistaken for systemic hypertension, that sort of common high blood pressure that people think, oh, you just take a medication for and it's not that big of a deal. So, you know, just a basic understanding of what PH doesn't really exist in the mainstream. And so most people have never heard of pulmonary hypertension until they experience it in some way in their life. And so so I think that causes difficulty for patients because there's just a lack of understanding of their situation. And because most people with pulmonary hypertension, you know, especially in the case of things like pulmonary arterial hypertension, you know, chronic illness that can be caused by, you know, can be idiopathic, can have no really other known cause and can occur in people who appear otherwise healthy, it can be very difficult for people to understand the limitations or the experience of people with PH because there's no physical signs, they've never heard of it, they don't have an understanding of what it's like or what the treatments are like. So, you know, unlike maybe people with cancer who might, you know, experience very similar burdens of illness, there's not that understanding and awareness in the general population for people with PH.
So, in your time with the association, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Well, just this last year, we conducted a survey of the Canadian PH population, and we had over 400 responses from patients, caregivers, and healthcare providers. And one of the things we learned that I'm very proud of, actually, is that the PH population in Canada really feel like they really understand their disease. They understand their treatment options, and they feel like they can make shared decisions or be actively involved in their treatment decisions with their healthcare team. They also feel they get a lot of support from their healthcare teams, so they have very strong relationships with their healthcare teams, and they also have strong relationships with each other. So, you know, all in all, I think the community building that has occurred in the PH community over the last 15 plus years and the strong network of patients that we have across the country, the Canadian family, as we like to call them, it's resulting in patients really feeling well supported, having access to good information, and being active participants in their care, which is what we want to see.
So, speak to an earlier point about the lack of awareness. If you could send any message to the community about the need to be better educated on this subject and the need to keep pushing forward for research, what would you say?
In fact, I would be most concerned even just with people understanding that these kinds of symptoms, this kind of unexplained breathlessness or shortness of breath, it doesn't go away with treatment for conditions, you know, like asthma or anxiety or other conditions that PH can often be confused for or misdiagnosed for. I would say, you know, that people should take those kinds of symptoms seriously. They very often we tell ourselves, oh, we're just getting older or we're out of shape or this isn't that big a deal. I can work around this. And they wait too long to go and seek medical attention. There's other issues in the medical system for sure in terms of shortening the time to diagnosis. But in terms of that awareness, I would encourage people to pay attention to those kinds of symptoms and especially if they're seeking treatment and not getting seeing improvements, that to be aware that PH can be difficult to diagnose and to learn those symptoms and have a conversation about that with their healthcare provider.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
My pleasure.
Thanks. In this segment of our show, Joe Von Coverden will be telling us a little bit about the Davis-Finney Foundation. So, can you tell me a little bit about your experiences with the foundation?
I was diagnosed about 10 years ago with Parkinson's. I was living up north at that time, so I eventually moved back down to central Ontario, I guess we call it. And my first visit to Parkinson's Canada was to go through their assessment process and introduction to what sort of material they had to support me. And I continued actively involved with them over the next 8 to 10 years and working at all different levels with the organization. I ran our local support group here in Peterborough for quite a while. Then I moved into the patient or Parkinson's Advisory Committee for the president at the Toronto office. And through that, I was able to participate in a Canadian roundtable where we connected with Parkinson's people all across the country, getting their views of how our treatment system is working. And since then, I've made an application to move up to the Parkinson's National Board to work at a higher level.
So with your own diagnosis, how did you cope with hearing that this was a reality for you, that you were going to have to find strategies to live with this condition?
Well, it was pretty shocking, because previously my doctor told me he didn't think it was Parkinson's, so I never did any research on what Parkinson's would mean to me or what it was. So I did get the confirmation of the diagnosis from the neurologist in Thunder Bay. I was quite taken back, and it took me a couple of years to really understand what that meant, and I was busy doing other things, career, marriage, house buying and selling. It took me a while to settle down to actually realize the implications for my life with having Parkinson's. So, I guess that's what we call the acceptance stage. It took me 2 years to work through the emotions, pushing them down and hiding before I started to react to the reality of my new sandbox, I guess you could say.
So that brings up an interesting point. Do you find there are any myths or misperceptions about Parkinson's out there?
One thing, I guess with a lot of people, a lot of us have tremors and some are worse than others. And unfortunately, it gives the appearance to people who are not familiar with Parkinson's that perhaps we are intoxicated. But the two aren't connected. So other myths are that a lot of people don't think you can die from Parkinson's. You normally pass away from complications of Parkinson's hand, something else. But there have been some people that have made the point that their parents or whatever have passed away from Parkinson's.
So, in your time providing support and information to those affected, has there been any success that you've seen?
Oh yeah, there's been some great successes. We have a young fellow here in Peterborough that was diagnosed with young onset Parkinson's, and he was only 24 or 25 when he was diagnosed, and he went from a totally healthy young man, 5'10", average weight, and very athletic, and over the next 2 years, two to three years, he totally lost his ability to walk, speak, or manage his own affairs of any sort. And he found actually a special type of wheelchair that he could use that allowed him to exercise his arms because he didn't have any strength in his legs anymore. And with that special wheelchair, which was lever operated rather than trying to push the wheels forward, it was an all-terrain, all-season wheelchair. And that allowed him to get out and do a lot of exercises. And that really changed his life. Even though he still has all those difficulties in living, no speech, no mobility to walk. He can't get through the day with his personal support worker. And he's a happy young man.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward and providing advocacy and support for those with Parkinson's, what would you say?
I'd say, please support us in our attempt to find cure or even things that will allow us to live more honorably in our old age. A lot of us, got this on our own. A lot of it's environmental, small amount is genetic. So it comes to you out of the blue. And if we will do our part by trying to keep fit, exercise, because that's our only alternative to work against it, is live better, live healthier. But there is a lot of money needed for research and support so we can improve the treatment systems that we use to improve our lifestyle.
So are there any accessible exercises you can recommend for someone with Parkinson's?
Well, because of COVID experience we just went through, there is a lot of exercise programs online that you can watch and follow through in your home. We just developed a new series through Trent University, Kinesiology Department, and work here from Peterborough. There is Parkinson's Canada. They have lots of videos online that you can follow, classes on a week-to-week basis. And in the States, the one I like to work with mainly is the Davis Finney Foundation. They have lots of courses online as well. So online classes are all over the place, from dancing with Parkinson's to boxing with Parkinson's. Well, boxing, by the way, is non-contact. It's just the theory of the boxing exercises are really good for us. It's very good if you can use both hands in the exercises so that your dominant hand and your weaker side get the same stimulation. And if you can't do anything else, just get out and walk. Walk around the block, walk around wherever you can. Stay active. Don't get seated on the couch too much. And get out there and just keep moving. If you can keep moving, then you can keep moving, which may sound a little redundant. But if you start to lose your mobility, the atrophication of your muscles, bones, and body mass will accelerate. And you, unfortunately, will shrink down to a bad posture and probably a lack of body mass that won't allow you to live without 24/7 personal support and no mobility of your own.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Think you've heard it all? Think again. Indian beatmaster Ritesh Das brings you the latest sound exploration with Japanese taiko, Macedonian folk, and Canadian rock icon Biff Naked. You've got to hear it to believe it. Juno-nominated Toronto Tabla Ensemble's new album, For the Love of Tabla, is out now.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Joe Van Coerden told us a little bit about his experiences with Parkinson's, and we heard a little bit about PHA Canada from Jamie Myra. In this segment of our show, Pat Hoochin will be telling us about stickler-involved people. So, can you tell me a little bit about stickler-involved people?
Well, we're a 30-year-old organization, which is very long-lived for for a mom and pop organization, we don't have a lot of extravagant funding, and nor do we have a lot of extravagant expenses. We've had 25 conferences in that 30 years, and we're really in the point of now needing to financially connect with the Marfan Foundation. So that's been a hard decision for our group, and a hard, but there's still not anybody that wants to step forward and take over the leadership. So we're at that process now. Stickler syndrome, because it isn't fatal, tends to have high intensity when they first diagnosed or looking for a diagnosis, and then people go down to the having to deal with the problems, that they're affected by, and that's about the intensity and interest they have. So anyway.
For those who might not be as familiar, how does Stickler syndrome typically affect someone?
Stickler syndrome is a connective tissue disorder, so it's a birth defect. The typical manifestations are retinal detachments and progressive hearing loss, and a lot of times a child will be diagnosed at birth because of their cleft palate or a submucous cleft palate. Micronanthia, the small recessed chin, is a very, very prominent detector of Stickler syndrome, as is a flat face. When the person's a baby, we kind of tend to grow out of that flat facial feature. And then the joints are the next thing that's affected, and that is also progressive. So as a person gets older, they have early onset arthritis, and then their back problems, their joint problems, early hip replacements in their 30s normally.
So do you know offhand about how many people are affected by Stickler syndrome?
The statistics are 1 in 10,000. But Stickler is a very underdiagnosed syndrome. Most people don't know that they have a syndrome, don't even connect the symptoms until they have a child that's severely defective or affected. Then they're diagnosed with also having Stickler syndrome. So if you have arthritis or knobby knees, big joints in your elbows, a submucous palate, wear glasses early on, you don't connect those things. So as I said, the statistic is 1 in 10,000. However, I live in a community of about 8,000 people, and I can name 15 people in this town with the proper diagnosis of Stickler syndrome. So I think it's a lot higher than 1 in 10,000.
So, your efforts, how do you reach out to the patient community?
We are on the internet, of course. That was where we first started, because when we started 30 years ago, there hardly was an internet, and there was really no information. We went literally to our community, or our close to community, library at the medical center there, and did our own research. Accumulated bibliography, and then we had someone that started up a website for us. That's been updated 3 or 4 times. We have 2 really good YouTube videos. Our website is www.sticklers.org, and on there are 2 really, really great YouTubes. One of them was done with the medical community in mind and for the newly diagnosed in mind, and the other is the video of good feelings and how to live with Stickler syndrome, helpful hints and just the positive probabilities that you're not going to end up blind and in a wheelchair. So we have those facilities. We also have a scholarship. High school seniors, as they graduate, can apply for a 4-year scholarship to go to a college of their choice. And that's well publicized all across the scholarship community. There are 4 different, well, we have 2 websites as far as being on We have a website, and then we're on Facebook in two different locations. And there are four or five different Stickler other Facebook groups that are not followed by us and not monitored by us, but there is still support for people.
So, in your time with Stickler-involved people, has there been any success that you've experienced that stands out for you?
I love to tell the story. We have the real success we've had is with our conferences. There, people come back every year because when they walk into a room, they immediately know they're with family. We were in Philadelphia the third year, third conference, and I was talking to a little three-year-old boy, and he looked up as two more little boys walked into the room, and they ran to the middle of that room and hugged each other because they knew they were related because they looked like each other. And that friendship for those three fellows has continued for this 27 years, because that was 27 years ago, and they're still friends and still give each other the community and support. I always feel we're very successful with our scholarships because we have kids that are going to college because of that. Our other successes are with adoptions because people contact me very frequently and want to know if they should adopt a child with Stickler syndrome. And I can give them the positive results that you don't always see on Facebook. So I think we have a very good success. If we were tallied that way, I think our success ratio with people getting the children adopted has been very good. And then, like I said, they're lifelong friends with other people in the group because we understand each other. We know without having to explain the terrors. Excuse me. The terrors of a genetic disorder. And we can give each other the support that's needed.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
My friends, I've come to notice more and more in recent memory, people have been struggling, sometimes for years on end, to get the proper diagnosis. And yes, treating the symptoms can make life a little easier for someone with a disability or a rare condition. However, they're not being treated for the correct thing. It creates a risk. Fact is, the first step in any sort of treatment or process of healing is always knowing what it is you're dealing with. Now, that being said, medical science, to me, is very much just a starting place, for it can never factor in human strength, the determination to rise to the impossible. People with disabilities do this all the time. Those who are told they might never walk again, they find a way. Those who are told they might never have children, sometimes they end up with the biggest families you'll ever hope to see. But understanding one's own condition does not mean succumbing to it. It means having a starting place, baseline from which begin that process of understanding the new normal of life. Now, for someone who's born into any given condition, it wouldn't be much of a change, for the world they see is the one that they have always known. For someone with an acquired disability, however, there can be a transitional process. But don't immediately jump to that card that says, there is no hope. Take it one step at a time. Try to understand the nature of the situation. And above all, understand you're not the only one. Understand that there are others out there who have gone through this and maybe even found a way of just handling the condition. Maybe they can teach you something. Maybe you can teach them something. But there's strength in community, my friends. And there is always hope to be found. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.